The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
All right. This is my first socialism talk, so I'm excited. Yeah, I'm that sucker that was like, yeah, in April, that's fine, I can totally do that. All right, so, but I want to preface this because it's technically labeled as a history talk or a labor history talk, but we're going to try to do it a little bit different in that I want to preface this in how we want to situate the talk. So we're situating it, even though it's a historical talk and we are going to go over these, within awareness of and anticipation of and a kind of hope of fostering a kind of a real discussion and of relevancy of like why this history is important and what kind of conclusions we should be seeking to draw from there. So we're situating around some key political questions or those that seem as such, both on the left broadly and at the conference this weekend. A couple examples of those, but not limited to, are, you know, what makes workers fight back? How do we overcome racism and build a multiracial organization and movements? I think this one in particular, I'd really be interested to keep in mind while we kind of go over some of this stuff is what is the character and context of struggle? And I bring that up, one of the things that I've personally noticed or I'm trying to investigate here that's kind of a through line is this conflation of conditions, societal conditions, and with context and consciousness that often leads to a lot of different questions that happen there. So I think by really digging deep into some of this history and the context through which some of these fights were born, we can start to get into some of these questions about conditions versus context and consciousness. And then the troubles with false hope and opportunism and how to identify those things. So ultimately, our goal in exploring the role of racism, our goal is to explore the role racism has played in class struggle as it pertains to Black folks in labor and multiracial organization, and we aim to bridge the gap that often exists between intellectually understanding this history versus internalizing and analyzing the political terrain, being able to take this history and actually, analyze the political terrain, not only historically, this is what existed then, through a Marxist framework and be able to take those things to what's happening right now. So, is this work? I don't know. I can also talk louder.
Yeah.
I'm going to do that. Let me know. Yeah. Because I have no problem with that. My family's from Mississippi and we have no shortage of talking loud. So, for brevity's sake, the talk is about Black workers and the rise of the CIO, which Black workers could mean a lot of different things, which is also, and that history could go way back. I'm going to start with, and we're kind of starting from Reconstruction up to the rise of the CIO and then what happened there. So, starting with the long and often overlooked history of interracial struggles in the U.S., so I'm going to begin with the abolition of slavery through which the potential was created for mass interracial working class movement in the U.S. But interracial struggles and organization existed long before the rise of the CIO, and there are a multitude of examples of Black and white farmers and rural poor folks in the South in particular, uniting and struggling together, specifically during the Reconstruction era and the populist era, so between 1866 and 1888 and 1896. And an important part an important note here is the first national organization of trade unions were formed 1 year after the Civil War. So the inaugural session of the National Labor Union took place just in August of 1866. And putting in some kind of dates here too, because another thing that is kind of this through line, this kind of cyclical nature here, these kind of fits and starts and struggles that happen pretty quickly, and that we're kind of going through now, we can very quickly see that wasn't a victory, but these things still have implications today, and we couldn't say that just because, some of this stopped, that it wasn't a victory. So there's lots of history and organizations that we should look into and that I could highlight as examples, but I'm going to kind of picked a couple key things that happened during this era, specifically focusing on the potential for multiracial organization. So founded in 1869, the Knights of Labor sought to organize all workers, both skilled and unskilled, men, women, white, black, within any particular industry. So they taught immigrants, for example, their rights as citizens, built cooperatives, and provided economic education and political reform opportunities. One of the particular things we want to focus on here is that they had organized a large, what will become a turning point in the industrial conflicts of that era. In 1877 was a wildcat strike that became, like, again, a turning point. So a couple key points here is that 100,000 workers were involved in this, but this again ended in riots, property damage, and a mass conflict with state and federal troops. And by the strike's end of such that it was, there was 100 to 200 people were dead, and like many hundreds were like imprisoned, and it's not a good look. However, but one of these things, but like this is another major turning point. You have 100,000 folks, and this is like 1877, black and white are organizing specifically around, and organizing a united and forming a united front for workers' rights. And this is a pivotal moment, even if it doesn't end, or it ends like tragically. So with the end of Reconstruction in 1877, which was around with the withdrawal of federal troops, kind of then led again to the return of like democratic power and saw the steady increase of racist violence. Also, in this era, populism was born in part was born in kind of response to some of this, but also born in response to some of the dire conditions, which is another aspect that needs to be understood and taken into context when we're like investigating, what exactly is happening and why we're talking about like white racism in particular. That it wasn't there were very real economic and material factors that were at play here. And to be more specific, both small farmers, tenants, and sharecroppers, both black and white, were facing these conditions. Economically, we're talking about the price of cotton falling from $1 a pound at the end of the Civil War to 7 cents a pound in 1891. And again, like looking at these like economic conditions that comes over and over again, that kind of forces, for lack of a better word, this kind of unity. But again, when we were going over several of these texts too, one of the things I don't like that a lot of people were saying is like, we don't want to say it forces it as if, and this is like racism was some kind of insurmountable or is some kind of insurmountable thing. They're like, well, we got to do this together. It was like, no, these conditions made it very evidently clear. This is the only way forward. So many Southern farmers, black and white, began to investigate. So how do we get forward? Because this is like absurd, and they realized their only hope lay in united struggles against these big planters and the capitalists. And so by the late 1880s, they began to organize cooperative efforts. And by 1890s, there were about 3 million white farmers who belonged to the Southern Farmers Alliance, and 1.25 million Southern black farmers who belonged to the Colored Farmers National Alliance. Both these groups started as fledgling unions in urban areas, but had a basis for provided a basis for this populist party as well. Another point here too is what often happens in these conversations of this particular era too, that kind of can be dismissive and doesn't take into like all of the full context in which they were operating. That even if they were like segregated unions or having separate unions, that does not mean that they were still operating in a very often in a united way. And you just really need to take into the full context of what's happening now. And I think that's something that we can kind of, one of those pieces, I think I'd like to bring that up in the conversation of like maybe an example of how that is an illustration of that and how that happens now. Both denouncing both major parties as tools of the capitalist, the populists adopted a broad platform. I'm going to skip around it because I think I'm getting pretty, I'm getting down on time, but some of the important parts that they adopted as part of this broad platform, which is important because you'll see what happens later, changes to the currency system that would help debt-stricken farmers, support for organized labor, shorter work days, government ownership of utilities, graduated tax system, democratic reforms to the political system as a whole, and female suffrage. But in the South, you know, this was, you know, obviously a huge issue for ruling class power, and proved to be, since it's such a big issue, they were they immediately fought back against. One of the key, is a key quote here from Tom Watson, who was a white congressional candidate and a part of the newly formed Populist Party. Here's one of the things recognizing the necessity for a multiracial organizing or organization. Said, "You are kept apart that they may be fleeced separately of your that you may be fleeced separately of your earnings. You are made to hate each other because upon hatred rests the financial despotism that enslaves you both. You are deceived and blinded that you may not know that you may not see how the race antagonism perpetuates a system that beggars both." And I think this is, I'm going to skip a little bit down here because, again, that was Tom Watson, who would then later go on to, so like with these like massive defeats or this like, there were lots of people that were actually coming together, which then, you know, ruling class powers obviously don't like. So what happens here then next? So efforts were defeated by a combination of racist hysteria, economic and social pressures, but also a classic capitulation to the Democratic Party and the co-optation by the Democratic Party, wherein they did in 1896, they put forth a presidential candidate who like took form, who like, borrowed from some of the rhetoric of reform of the Populist Party, like borrowed, and the Democrat, with no intention of like making any real changes, because that never happens. And so they're paying lip service to all these things, and like ultimately that proved successful. So the Democrat the Democratic candidate in 1896 in the 1896 presidential elections, again, was moving more towards this kind of taking on some of the reformist aspects without any intention of carrying those things through. And so again, Tom Watson, you kind of going over to the center again, like capitulated and ended up actually embracing what became the Democrats' call for white supremacy. And this is the same person I just quoted at length, trying to like point out these differences and how those are used as a tool. But I think this is a really important part that we want to keep bringing up, and I'd like to investigate more and bring this up into discussion, because some of these pieces aren't really brought out as we kind of know this history, but it's not as much used in some of the things that we're trying to fight now, or the conversations and debates that we're having now. It's like, oh, well, this has always happened, and this might be the first time, probably the first time at least today, that anyone's going to quote Oprah. But in terms of this type of specifically with the Democrats in the beginning of this, and it's like Oprah, I think she was quoting Maya Angelou, she said, when someone shows you who they are, believe them. And this is 1896, and it's like, you know, this like continues to happen over and over again. So I'm going to go pretty quickly here. Going into a craft unionism and the color bar. So by the 1890s, national economic recovery had led to the revival of trade union membership. By 1897 and 1904, the AFL grew 360%. But again, which was kind of continuing with this period right before what was happening there, they capitulated to Jim Crow segregation, the Capitalist Party's needs, like initiating a color bar, wherein they were organizing only skilled craft workers, the vast majority of whom were native whites. So having accommodated to white supremacy and allied themselves with the Democratic Party in the 1890s, the AFL kind of rendered itself incapable of meeting some of the industrial challenges or the challenges of industrial unionism that like would be born or continue or were starting to kind of show themselves. So as organizations for the defense of workers' interest within capitalism was basically what they became, trading or organized workers. They kind of came together around the lowest common ideological denominator, which was racism often. So skip around a bit to the Great Migration and the furthering of the divide. And I didn't get a chance because it was like, again, this gets into a lot of things, and I hope some people bring this up into the conversation, particularly as it pertains to using how a lot of these unions and the Capitalist Party will then use race, not in the traditional way to drive wedges, but then they kind of use some of these how, like, and I think Todd is going to get this in, get into this a little bit more about how we'll drive wedges or create economic wedges in within Black communities and with white communities themselves. So, by, let's see, in a workforce already divided by skilled and unskilled, or like native and immigrant, there are additional economic pressures and post-war demobilization that made circumstances, you know, unfavorable, so to speak, in the North for the newly arrived mass amounts of black folks who had migrated there. But one of the pieces that we're not really getting too much into, which is super fascinating, is there ways that race was deployed by some of these unions and factories in the North to get those folks up there. And I hope we can get that into the discussion, because that really gets into some of this false sense of, or this sense of creation of false solidarity in a very particular way that I think is manifesting itself in a different way now. So if folks could speak more to that. But so 90% of African Americans had lived in the South, the vast majority of which previously were in like sharecropping rural areas, but because of the like aforementioned violence that was happening. Thank you. Some of the unions started to like negotiate and kind of build this better, like a better life that's up here. Obviously that wasn't like what was happening there when they arrived here. But many of the unions in industrial jurisdictions like in the North and in the South used kind of some of that same bottom line, not actual real solidarity to get people up to the North, which kind of then engendered some of this distrust that was born out of the community organizations that was organizing that was happening within Black communities, which Todd is going to focus on. But one of the overarching things we wanted to do was kind of start with the kind of history of what was happening and building multiracial organizations in the South, particularly around this idea of white racism and kind of debunking that as that being the main source of dissent or disagreement there, and then kind of go into the Black, what was happening in Black communities and Black organizing itself. So.
Got a lot going on. Cool. Can folks hear me?
Cool.
Right, like Destiny said, I'm gonna try and just give a little bit more context around like what it was like for Black workers to organize and also relate to some of the existing unions during, mostly I'm gonna be focusing on the period of like the Great Depression and a little bit the late sort of 1920s. I'm gonna pull from two books, pull some quotes from two books that I think folks should definitely go to the Haymarket Room and grab. Mainly one, Organized Labor and the Black Worker by Philip Foner, and then Class Struggle and the Color Line by Paul Heidemann. Definitely the Paul Heidemann book. There's some saucy socialists dance back and forth that I greatly appreciated in reading this. So, give me 15. Cool. So, for Black people, the U.S. working class, and for socialists, one of the most important sites of struggle for our advancement and against racism was labor, specifically in labor unions, right? And for Southern Black sharecroppers, the need for organization to protect themselves against exploitation and the seemingly unlimited power of landowners was obvious. So Foner quotes Black organizer Clyde Johnson, who says the union represented, quote, the union represented hope and protection. It was their voice. But the traditional labor unions, like those that existed during the Great Depression, the AFL, and later its union affiliates, were not viable sort of locations for their objectives either. Blacks for years had urged unions like the AFL and United Mining Workers to honor their commitments to organize irrespective of color, but quickly realized, as one Black miner noted, quote, the words didn't amount to anything. nothing worth the paper they were printed on. For in deeds, discrimination was rank everywhere. The bureaucracy that existed in labor unions, especially in the AFL, refused to cross the color line. And at least not without monumental struggle, which black workers were willing to wage. Racism that permeated the unions might have been promulgated from the leadership, but it was definitely accepted by rank and file white union members. And when black workers, or when blacks did try to organize for better working conditions, or simply in assertion of their rights, they were met with, at best, being shut out of the unions, and at worst, fatal violence, right? And in fact, when sharecroppers organized for a better sharecropping contract and a role in determining wages and for freeing of their union brothers from jail, these are sharecropper union brothers who organized in support of the Scottsboro Boys case, they actually won. But the victory was short-lived and resulted in the murder of three black men and the arrest of six during a race riot in 1932. Furthermore, the benefit of integrating unions and mounting a multiracial fight against both the exploitation from landowners, factory bosses, the rich and powerful was missed by some socialists in socialist organizations and had to be argued. Right, so in Paul Heideman's book, right, Eugene Debs, for example, in debating another socialist who chose to remain anonymous, of the SP, right, about 30 years earlier, he wrote, "The man who seeks to arouse prejudice among working men is not their friend. He who advises the white wage worker to look down upon the black wage worker is an enemy to both." Now, he said a lot more and came at this dude really, really hard, as he should have. And so I encourage folks to read over that. It's telling and shocking, like, what kind of the strength of the argument of the person who Eugene Debs was arguing, like the political strength of it, and even though it was like wholly racist, and disgustingly racist, the Trade Union Educational League and later the Trade Union Unity League, both USCP formations of radical trade unionists, one following the other, codified the fight for equality for the black worker, both on and off the job, into their constitutions. Separate but equal unionism was outlawed within those unions. When they organized white and black mill workers, the mill owners accused the TUL of quote unquote breaking the color line, to which the TUL responded, "Yeah, we did." And when the mill owners distributed handbills stating, quote, "You believe in white supremacy. Would you belong to a union which opposed white supremacy?" Fauna writes, quote, the miserably paid, overworked white textile workers still stood firm and endorsed the National Textile Workers Union's response. Unity between white and black workers, full stop. Plain and simple. By the end of the Great Depression, Fauna notes that a key demand of left-wing groups and unions affiliated with the AFL was, quote, "the right of the Negroes to join all unions and to work on all jobs in all trades. The only way for rank and file to destroy Jim Crow unionism was to destroy Jim Crow unionisms. The rank and file must at once put a stop to such discrimination. If the unions are to present a solid, united front against the employers, if their demands are not to be won, this Jim Crow policy must be wiped out." Are to be won, not to be won. Blacks and socialists especially began the work of combating the recalcitrant and racist union bureaucracy to force the unions to open their doors to black workers, including and include the interests of black workers in their organizing efforts and strategy, as they had promised. Some of the most talented organizers and notable organizations were involved in these struggles, including the likes of A. Philip Randolph, the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, NAACP, and Urban League. As a matter of fact, unions, including organizations like the TUEL and the TUUL, used reports produced by NAACP and Urban League to make their case for not only integrating the unions, but shifting the direction and priorities of union leadership, and in many cases, actively work together with membership of black roots, black grassroots organizations on the ground to recruit black workers to the unions. And I'll get into that a little bit later. By 1935, black membership in unions had increased, and the AFL, there's still very little of any of anything had changed. John P. Davis, a secretary of the Joint Committee on National Recovery, a coalition of 22 major black organizations, urged the national office of the AFL to carry out a six-point program. And I'm going to read from that real quick. One, ban constitutional color bars. To prohibit separate Jim Crow locals and insist that local unions abide by the prohibition. Three, abolish federal labor unions composed exclusively of blacks excluded from trade unions. Four, urge that a black be placed on the executive council, a black. Five, employs some black organizers, quote, and a few Negro girl clerks here to headquarters where you have none. Six, launch a nationwide educational campaign to show the entire membership that, quote, there can be no American labor movement that's worth a tinker dam until the Negro and white workers are organized together. He goes on to say, A. Philip Randolph testified on behalf and endorsed Davis' plan and said plan and counseled the educational campaign and said that it should be hitched up with practical concrete acts, such as a public declaration of the council and at the convention. That no national or international would be permitted to remain in the federation, which persistently practiced discrimination. Okay, so I'm gonna try. So the NAACP also endorsed the Davis plan, but offered a three-point plan, which was significantly weaker. But still called for some advancements. I just like to know, like, the NAACP is like the bad gift that you always get. It's like, I appreciate it, but like, I didn't need a blender. I didn't like a crock pot. Charles A. Houston of the NAACP General Council also endorsed Davis' plan and recommended his own markedly weaker, like said that. So debates over these programs would get underway at the AFL convention of that year, and were long and heated and boiled over into a fist fight between John L. Lewis and Bill Hutchinson. The AFL convention that year happened with the backdrop of blacks experiencing some of the harshest poverty and largest swaths of black population seeking government relief. Fonner notes, quote, on March 19th, 1935, the point of desperation was passed as Harlem exploded into a riot. 3 blacks were killed by police, and $2 million worth of property damage destroyed. The press attributed the riot, known as the quote-unquote Black Ides of March, to quote-unquote communist agitation. Every time black folks rise up, it's the communists. It's fine, I'll take it. But it was clear that the outburst was the product of widespread unemployment, starvation, poor housing, police brutality, in short. And as the mayor's commission on conditions in Harlem put it, quote unquote, widespread discontent. Quote unquote, it was not a riot, Adam Clayton Powell Jr. Correctly noted. It was an open, unorganized protest against empty stomachs, landlords, merchants, discrimination in relief, disenfranchisement, and against the disinterests of the administration. Sounds very, very familiar. So in short, nothing has changed, or at least very, very little today. And by the end of the AFL convention, both programs put forward were defeated, and with, except for the, I think the, like one of the points of the NAACP plan, and with it, as Farner put it, the last vestige of confidence blacks had in the AFL, coinciding with the AFL rejection of the demands to change union structure to prioritize the needs of the majority of mass production industries. This didn't kill all enthusiasm to organize black workers, and the industrial unionism as a whole. From this movement of white and black industrial workers, the Committee of Industrial Organizations was formed. However, like in the lead years following the CIO's formation, the NAACP, because of its close affiliation with employers, refused to help recruit black workers. But where they refused to help recruit black workers, the Urban League and other black grassroots organizations did take up the cause to recruit black workers. Enthusiastically. The reason why the NAACP refused to recruit black workers is because they thought the CIO was too radical and too communistic. Sounds like an old grandparent. I think I'll leave it there for now, and hopefully we can have further discussions about like what that organizing looked like. And this year you...
Yeah. So really quickly before we get into the discussion, a couple of things that we want to say. So this history demonstrates very quickly that the consciousness of workers, while contradictory, is very fluid, or often contradictory, is very fluid, that these ideas, including racist ideas, change in struggle. But if one of the things in particular where we can use this particular history and the essential nature and the essential qualities of black workers and importance of understanding the struggle of black workers in this country to really elucidate like what the particularities of what change and struggle means. Because I think one of the things that's coming up in a lot of our conversations is we're not really articulating what struggle means and the character of struggle, and there gets a lot of confusion and debates that aren't actually debates start to kind of come out there. So one of the things is that where black and white workers it's clear through all of this history where they're working together, where they're same job, same struggle, side by side for longer periods of time. Of course, that's an easier. That's where it's been shown that dominant racist ideas can forge links between the common enemy and the employer. And I wanted to bring this idea up in particular because there's been, particularly around the most recent teacher strikes, what I found, frankly, to be, and I think Todd and I have talked about this too, kind of an overexcitement and a kind of a lack of investigation of like maybe why we didn't think that it would happen in the South, or why this is like, why there? But it's like, well, if you look at the economic conditions there and investigate this history, it was like, yes, there, this isn't, you know, so what are the other implications of or things that we weren't really thinking about in particular, what kind of like, kind of holdovers from this period are we, you know, not really investigating there? And another piece of this, and we started to get into it, or Todd just started to get into it with our everyone's favorite terrible gift giver, the NAACP, where Black workers have like continuously demonstrated throughout history a willingness to join unions despite, you know, major union policies that were not in their best interest. And but there was also always like an anti-union line, almost always an anti-union line coming from the Black middle class, and it is expressing itself in a different way now, and I think we can get into that conversation or start bringing in those points of like what exactly that means and how it's kind of manifesting itself as kind of Black capitalism and those aspects. So, because there's been a concrete history of, you know, Black folks in these Black communities, it not really do being a question of, you know, class versus race, but like how do we move these struggles forward? And I think that's in particular a very strong line for us to, you know, investigate further. Because again, it's like a concrete debate. Like, so how do we get to where we want to go? How do we get free? Because then we have these questions that we're starting to get into, like yesterday, about like white privilege and what these other things mean. That kind of start to tactically circumvent, like, you know, how do we talk to people? How it's like they're people. This history, like, and in struggle, you know, like it's kind of circumventing what struggle actually means. And so, like, knowing this history, investigating it, then that question is kind of rendered moot of, you know, how do we talk to people and what does privilege mean? And like, because it's not really investigating or engaging with what struggle means and how struggle erupts. So that's a particular aspect we were hoping that we would take up in this discussion today.
Cool. And then I just wanted to, as we wrap up this talk, I wanted to give some more actual, like, concrete data today of like what Black labor and Black employment looks like in the U.S. Because I think it's important, right, as we think about how we advance these struggles, that we equip ourselves with the proper information and the right interpretation of it too. So, right, much of the reporting on employment in mainstream media says that more and more people are becoming employed, we're recovering, right? Including Black folks. And the question is, what kind of jobs are people getting? What sectors of industry are workers being employed, of Black workers being employed? Can people live off of the wages that they're earning, right? Well, according to numerous reports, like those reported by the National Academy of Science, they argue that Americans are widely overestimating the progress made in shrinking the wage gap between Black and white workers. Realization of this misconception reflects a decided and persistent feature of the US, that is ignoring racism, sort of. Ironically, which I think is changing in the last few years, ironically, much of this misplaced optimism is taking place taken up by white Americans, which flow from a refusal to accept the sort of notion that despite the passage of civil rights legislation, much of the day-to-day lives of Black folks haven't not changed, and including our experience in the labor force. In researching this history, I realized that like many social and political issues impacting Black people and that have impacted Black people throughout the history of the U.S., not only has remained relatively stagnant, but conditions have backslid. And Black people are still among the lowest wage earners in the U.S. despite the widely reported downward trend of U.S. unemployment. And according to a September 5th, 2007 report from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, the quote-unquote average African-American worker, male or female, is more likely to be unemployed than their white counterparts, right? What's interesting, or what's sad, is the report goes on to say that unemployment gap between whites and Blacks is widened to 6.9% during times of recession, of which Black people are the majority of whom exist in lower economic standing. I think we all know this. And finally, according to the same report, these outcomes are not a result of education, age, or experience, but other quote unquote unmeasured factors. Right. It's very interesting wording. So now some of the most significant factors of the gap in earnings are in industries in which blacks and whites are work. Black folks typically work in industries with lower levels of productivity. And today, which shouldn't come as a shocker, that's always been a thing. Black folks have always been employed in unskilled labor over skilled labor. Another argument of misplaced optimism or research, sort of sleight of hand, that prevails in U.S. society is that more educated blacks have a better chance and ultimately better success in the job market. And I think, like, in the current context of this administration, the rise of the far right, like, this is the line that the racists from organizations like Turning Point USA, like Ben Shapiro and Candace Owens, perpetuate as an explanation for the progress of some blacks while the majority of blacks continue to struggle under persistently restrictive conditions. And according to this report, the same report from the Federal Reserve Bank of San Francisco, when looking at education, black men and women with degrees from institutions of higher education still experience a shortfall in earnings compared to their white counterparts. What's striking is that for black men, the black-white earning gap is slightly higher for those with bachelor's degrees than those with high school diplomas. For black women, the earning gap remains higher for those with high school diplomas than those with college degrees. One thing is certain, this misconception has a deleterious impact on black folks' ability to survive the economic valleys of capitalism that capitalism produces during downturns, and it also obscures people's full view of the existence of racism in America and how racism is administered. Furthermore, this ignorance places a barrier rooted in the history of racial inequality to the very possibility of improving our living conditions. And you know, socialists, we understand, or we should understand, that this ignorant misconception also has a deleterious impact on the working class as a whole. So, I mean, my question is, like, what do we do with all of this context? The context of the Janus decision and the wave of teacher strikes, the disproportionate representation of black workers in public sector unions, which is a good disproportion. And while the sort of last hired, first fired mantra still applies, and working conditions for blacks are still abysmal. And I'll leave that.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.